Celebrate with Radio Gorgeous. We've reached 100 authors of the week. Hooray!
Why should a woman who is healthy and strong blubber like a baby if her man goes away, weeping and wailing how he's done her wrong? That's one thing you'll never hear me say. Never gonna think.
A massive hello to Daisy Waugh, novelist and journalist. How are you, Daisy?
Very well, thank you very much.
Great. So just to say that today is an amazing day because we're celebrating. This is the 100th author of the week and you're on the week of 100th authors.
See, that's good news. I feel honoured.
Exactly. I hope you're very honoured.
I am.
So this is your third time on Radio Gorgeous, but let's go to your latest novel, Honeyville. A tough place to be a woman in 1913, but it was the best place in the West to find one if you had the cash. Now, you wanted to call the book Snatchville.
Did I tell you that? Yes, I did. I still wish I had, but everyone got a bit mincy and said they were too scared of their own body parts, so I wasn't allowed to call. I mean, feminism hasn't really got off the starting block until you can call a book Snatchville, I think, but there you have it.
Honeyville is referenced in the book. What is Honeyville? Why is it called that?
Because the town where it's set, it's all based on real events. The town where it's set was the one town in the Midwest and the Southwest that allowed prostitution. In fact, half the town's wealth was based on prostitution. There were sort of architecture and sort of statues. And there's a madame in my book who is based on a true character. It was called Snatchville. That's what it was called, because it's the place where people went to get laid, but I wasn't allowed to call it that.
There's two women in the book, Dora and Inez, and Dora is a prostitute and Inez is high society, so how the hell do they become friends?
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite high society. It's a small town in the middle of nowhere, so what she is a kind of rich, middle-class girl, which really means that she's dainty, it's not quite high society, because there would be a wildness there, and actually what she comes from is a very sort of restricted, prissy background. And I think the reason they got together is because neither was particularly comfortable in their rather oppressive worlds, and they were lonely. It's just loneliness.
So let's get these two characters into place. Let's talk about Dora, the prostitute. How did you get in the head of a prostitute?
I mean, it's quite easy to get into the head of a prostitute, isn't it? If you're somebody who has ever engaged with the opposite sex, almost, or used your sexuality to get something, or felt that your sexuality was being exploited. And I think most women would identify with that. And I think all novel writing is about taking a core of something, some experience, and applying it to the situation. So that was very easy, actually.
Now, she didn't, as nearly everybody, doesn't set out to be a prostitute. It happens by accident.
It does with her, yeah. She's someone who's sort of allowed life to happen to her a bit. And she's clever. I love her, actually. She's a thoughtful, intelligent, slightly sort of separate woman who started life as a singer in vaudeville. I never know how you pronounce that word, because I've only ever read it.
Vaudeville,
is it?
Yeah,
vaudeville.
Yeah.
And she was doing this, I think it was called the Southwest Tour, and her husband ran off with the other woman in the troupe. So.
And then she ended up there, and then she was ruled by a madam who was a very horrible, unsavoury character.
She's quite creepy, isn't she? She's based on a real character. No, that's unfair, because I don't know if the real character was like that, but she, there's the whole idea of who's controlling who and this kind of pretense at luxury, and then the whole idea of how do you keep people there if they've actually got enough money to go. Because prostitutes weren't allowed any credit in the town, so all their bills were sent to the madame, and then they would have to repay them. So obviously you're a sitting duck for exploitation at that point. Plus there's this sense if you're earning quite a lot of money, or you feel as though you're earning a lot of money, so it's all coming in, but you're never actually touching it. So this woman has her almost, really, she's a sex slave, really, I suppose. I mean, she's a high-class prostitute, but the money, somehow, the madame, who is in fact one of the richest women in the world, in the city, as indeed was the woman I based it on, unbelievably rich and powerful, would sort of do kind of dodgy accounting and say, actually, you bought a dress here. And because this madame had this town in her hand, the prostitutes didn't really have much to say. I mean, they couldn't really argue. They had to take it or like it or lump it.
Now let's talk about Inez, who was more lively a character, never stopped talking, fun. She worked in a library, which I don't know how she kept quiet. But she just hadn't had life experiences apart from in books,
really. She'd been protected by this sort of boring bourgeois life. And and could sense. She's not that bright, but she's got a sort of... I mean, she's a kind of...
She had charisma, though, didn't
she? Had a lot of charisma, a lot of charm, but she's a kind of half-formed person, and that's part because, I think, she was never allowed to be formed. She kind of brought up in this protected world where nice ladies didn't really do anything except... sort of by time till it was time to breed. Anyway, she's not very bright, but she's got this incredible hunger for life and this sort of vivacity and charm. She's very pretty, and I like her because it sort of turns in on itself. What she is somebody who from the outside looks like she has everything. She's someone who Heat magazine would probably be spiteful about and watching the size of their arse at this point. Someone who's just pretty, charming, rich. It's like keeping an animal in a zoo. She's not allowed to be a human being. She's just a sort of piece of decoration, and she does pay for that in the end.
And it's through her friendship with Dora that lets her free.
Up to a point, opens a window and allows her to realise that there is, you know, she doesn't have to lead the life that she was leading. But because she's so ill-prepared for a life outside of this sort of dainty world that she moves in, she gets herself into a lot of trouble. But she, you know what? She has quite a lot of fun along the way.
Yeah, I think she does. Now, this isn't just a story about two women. This is a story taken from a real life cutting that you read. It was a terrible tragedy in American history.
Yes, it was. And I spent a week in this little town, which is now, it's like a time warp, the place where it's happened, and the people. It happened almost exactly 100 years ago, this tragic thing, and the people who live there. It's still, you know, a very raw subject.
Is there like a museum to it?
Well, no, because people are kind of sort. Because what happened was it's coal mining land, and there was it was a time of in across the world of tremendous worker unrest, and the Miners Union of America decided to invest all their sort of energies, political energies, on this one strike that was going on in this small town called Trinidad. So it became this appalling. Went on through the coldest winter on record, this long winter that the miners, who had plenty of reasons to complain, were thrown out of their mining towns and living in canvas through this, and it was awful. But the thing was that no side, because it's babyish ever to say that one side are complete goodies and one side is complete bad, both sides were incredibly violent and sort of vile, actually. And so there was this kind of killing that went on and on through this long winter. With everybody being, you know, and it was a very dangerous and nasty time, and the thing exploded when the obvious baddies, the capitalists, threw everyone out of this canvas camp where they'd been living out the winter, and set fire to the tents. And in fact, a lot of them had built dugouts under the tents because it was slightly warmer. And in the maternity tent, it is quite awful. I think there were 8 women and 11 children were too frightened to come out. Because of all these fires shooting all day, and they were found in the morning asphyxiated because the tent had been set fire to. So that caught the attention of the national press and became a massive thing. And this city was a national disgrace, and the press from everywhere and the kind of intellectuals from everywhere, which is what frames the book, sort of poured into this tiny little one-horse town of very parochial, not very sophisticated people. And this sort of fought their own political war, the unionists and the capitalists and the sort of New York Greenwich Village intellectuals poured into this little town. And Ines, innocent little librarian, and my lovely friend, the old hooker, were sort of stuck in the middle of it. And it's the sort of story about how, just the sort of difference between trying to lead your life and this sort of boisterous... violence of people who have ideologies, and they don't, you know, and the cost that has on people who are just actually trying to get on with their lives.
All this week, celebrating 100 author interviews on RadioGorgeous.com. But the tragedy is that you said that it didn't actually change anything.
No.
I mean, you'd think that something good would come out of it, like workers' rights or something, but you said it was just a tragedy.
It was just a tragedy.
Is that because it's such a capitalist country?
I think it's just because that's the way most things work, isn't it? I think, that's just the way the world turns. No, nothing good did come out of it.
I'm intrigued.
Except my novel.
Yeah. You went back there, and what was left?
Well, there is a monument in the field where these people died and where the people set out their camps, about 10 miles out of town. and the town. I mean, all the opera house and the theatre and the places and the
they're
cinema.
They're all mentioned in the book.
They're all mentioned in the book. They're all still there, and most of them are boarded up. It's incredibly pretty. And well, you know, like Main Street America is sort of, but this is, it's in the middle of the prairie. It's in the middle of nowhere. And you can see that it's got this incredible opera house and the biggest theatre in the West, all of it falling down. And the
sounds
department
quite
store.
Magical but spooky.
It's incredibly magical. I mean, it's just love. It's, you know, for a novelist or for anyone, it's just that sense that you are really stepping into a film set or a piece of history. It's magical. It's incredibly pretty. But the thing is that I there were various historians, local historians, and the newspaper is still running. Astonishingly, it still makes money and looks pretty.
No newspapers run anymore.
Well, 10 cowboys that still live there. Anyway. There was a historian who showed me around, and she was lovely and balanced about it all. And obviously, because she lived there, her grandparents had been. Great grandparents. She introduced me to people who, you know, from both sides of the argument, people who had run the company store in the sort of miners' towns, so capitalists, and sort of terrifically left wing. Although to be fair, I think that the people there who were sort of on the side of the miners tended not to be locals. They were people who,
because it was that the immigrants came were
and
the
they
miners.
Went when they because in fact the working conditions weren't that great, so they went where the work was. And a lot of people just wandered off after that because it was too unpleasant. But what's really weird about it is that this is what's really creepy. Well, it's not. It's just, it's a magical thing how mad we all are and how we try to put sort of neat little morals and tops and tails
like
on
they're
the top
good,
of stories.
They're bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A year after this strike, when all these people had died, and it had been the bloodiest and most awful time. In fact, there was anarchy, and they had to call in the national troops. The president had to send in the National Guard to reinstore order. The man who owned the mines, Rockefeller, came down and did a kind of tour of make-peace, tour of honour. And he was eating in the miners' houses, and he drove down Trinidad, the high street in Trinidad, and they were all, which is also in my book, they were all dancing and cheering. And dancing behind his car. This was the man who had actually seen their children living out in the tents, who'd been, you know, ultimately responsible for this appalling murder and the crappy conditions that they all lived in. And yet, you know what? He was a celebrity, and it was time to celebrate. And it sort of, I don't know, it sort of half makes you despair, and it half makes you think, well, actually, you know what? It's just so it goes, and so the world turns, and.
Yeah, and its history keeps repeating itself.
History keeps,
Now, thanks so much for talking about Honeyville. Which is published by HarperCollins. But what I want to ask is about, we're talking about female friendships recently on Radio Gorgeous. And I want to ask you, because obviously this book is all about female friendships, what makes a good friend to you? What are you looking for in a friend?
Well, I think, it's changed as I've got older. And now I think very old friends. Like, I really have got very old friends. Initially people who, I mean, you know, people who are quite naughty and people who were funny, sort of wild and funny. And now, you know, I've got a bit older. I mean, my old friends are the ones I really care about. I think being funny and being clever and being quite serious.
I find that they knew me when I was wild, you know, so it's like you really know me, you know my spirit.
Yeah.
Whereas now if you meet someone, say, through your children or through work or something, they don't know you. They don't know.
But what I really can't bear, what I cannot bear, I don't think I made a single friend through,
school gate.
Through the school gate or through... I can't bear friendships made where you go as a couple and then meet another couple. It's like this is dead before it started. I can't bear. It's got this great big stink of respectability around it, which is just...
I can really see that. Yeah, it's like we're all pleased of ourselves.
Yeah.
Yes, and
we're
share.
We're safe and we're not going
we're like saying out the Sunday supplements.
Yes, exactly.
Now, do you have different friends for different occasions?
Again, in the olden days, when I, you know, wanted to go on a bender, I'd ring somebody, or when I wanted to... Yeah, I think I probably still do a little bit. There are people you know are kind of...
Have you got a cry-on-your-shoulder friend?
Yes, I have.
I've got a friend who I can just ring up and just cry and talk about myself for an hour. And are you still there? Yes, I'm still there. And it's like, and she lives in France, but I still, you know, she is the one I ring.
Yeah,
you know.
And I, you know, and it's reciprocated as well. I think that's... But, and I've got one. I've got one. No, Veronica confide in a bit, but actually, as I get older, I get more. I don't really need to so much anymore. You just sort of roll with the punches. You can moan to your husband
if they listen.
Which you know they don't. Actually, I heard myself moaning about something so pathetic this morning. I suddenly played it back in my ear, and it made me laugh. It really cheered me up. Actually, love it. What the hell? What? Thank God nobody's listening.
Excellent. Now, also, have you ever had a toxic friend? Have you had a friend that's made you feel worse or drained your energy?
It's interesting. I think possibly I've become less toxic. I don't know that. I mean, I think some of my
friends.
You're less toxic. Yes. My old friends, some of them, I mean, a lot of my old friends, the friendship used to be a hell of a lot more competitive than it is now. And I think now, you know, that we've all been knocked around a bit. We've all got nicer, and the competition seems completely trivial, and it's irrelevant. So I have actually quite a small group of very close friends. I don't really have any friends that I don't
trust. Yeah. You haven't had to get rid of somebody.
Well, I have over the years. It's just
Years. Yeah, you grow out of each other. Yeah. That's what I find.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And Honeybill is published by HarperCollins.
Daisy Moore is proud to be Radio Gorgeous 100th Author of the Week.
Celebrating 100 author interviews on Radio Gorgeous all this week.
Everybody come in and have a good time.
I've been right behind you the whole way.
I know, I heard you.
Aunt Ella, I reckon I better.
Oh, can't I come too, Curly? I just love to watch the way you handle horses.
About all I can handle, I guess.
Another mile in that buggy with that Perkins boy, and I've lost my mind.
I'll take Will, but you don't want him. Looks like Curly's took up that Cummins girl.
What'd I care about that?
Why should a woman who is healthy and strong blubber like a baby if her man goes away, weeping and wailing how he's done her wrong? That's one thing you'll never hear me say. Never gonna think that the man I lose is the only man among men. I'll snap my fingers to show I don't care. I'll buy me a brand new dress to wear. I'll scrub my neck and I'll brush my hair and start all over again. Many a new face will please my eye. Many a new love will find me. Never have I once looked back to sigh over the romance behind me. Many a new day will dawn before I do. Many a light lad may kiss and fly. A kiss gone by is bygone. Never have I asked an August sky, where has last July gone? Never have I wandered through the rye.
radiogorgeous.com.